Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's July 31st, 2019. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. All right. So back to Lyme and Ron here.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Well, you know, okay. I'm going to say okay. Still have a sore knee.
Your knee is still sore?
Still sore. Oh. Yeah, knee's still sore. 9 weeks of antibiotics. And that part is still a big question mark. The other thing, the thyroid thing,
yes,
that is seemingly better.
Right, it's improving. Do you feel like we have the right dose for you yet?
I think so. I'm not real sure.
And you're taking 100 micrograms of levothyroxine right now.
I am right now. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's working for you
so far.
Do you think maybe you need more?
Maybe.
Yeah, we're going to have to do.
It might be worth an experiment.
Well, and you could take, the first thing to do would probably be to take one of those 50s and cut it in half and do 125. And that's where I would go next.
Okay.
Because you're at 100. Instead, don't go right up to 150. Go cut it in half and do 125 and see if that works. And then ultimately, hopefully, we'll find a dose for you that works and we'll get the right, pills so you can mix and match.
Yeah. And the thing is that the sleepy lethargic thing is getting better.
That's great.
It's definitely getting better, which is critical because, one of the problems that I've had was sleeping while driving the car.
So soon.
Not sleeping, but,
getting very, very sleepy
while driving. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that seems to have helped.
Well, the thing is, too, with sleeping while driving the car, that could be your hypothyroidism, but it's also a thing that has nothing to do with hypothyroidism.
Oh, I understand.
Didn't you used to take Greg into the car to lull him to sleep?
Oh, yeah.
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 Then because the vibration and the motion, some people get sleepy just from riding in a car. That's a thing. So that's something to think about, people, that if you get sleepy in a car, it doesn't necessarily mean, because I had a patient come to me not too long ago who she said, I get sleepy in the car, but as soon as I get out, I feel fine. And it's not that she's tired. It's that the motion actually lulls you into calmness and getting sleepy. It's like being rocked when you're a baby. That's what it is.
Lovely.
That's pretty funny. So, all right. So meanwhile, you have this diagnosis of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which means that you have, and fortunately you have a low level of antibodies going after your thyroid gland. So it's not, and I've had patients who their thyroid peroxidase antibodies were as high as 4,000 or they're in the thousands. Yours are 30, which is not super high at all. And so thank goodness that that's the way it is. I mean, you do have autoimmune antibodies to your thyroid gland, but there's not a lot of them, which is great. And the fact that you avoid gluten probably helps with that, because when you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, gluten aggravates Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
Right.
But the thing is, with the last time we checked your TSH, it was 14, and you should not be walking around with a TSH of 14. So what I'm going to do, I have to order more labs here. I have to see what date your last thyroid labs were ordered, and I need to order more labs for you. Because what you do is, when somebody is newly on thyroid medication, you really should do their thyroid hormones monthly or less for the first little while until they're feeling well, because you want to see where they are. I want to see if how far down your TSH has come. So that will be important. I'm guessing it's not down all the way, or it could be down in the normal range. Anyway, we'll see. So that will be interesting to see. And then in the meantime, you had the diagnosis of babesiosis. So, by the way, ticks are the gift that keeps on giving. You can be bitten by one tick and get three illnesses.
Yeah.
I had a patient not too long ago who was very blessed to have been infected with Lyme, ehrlichiosis, or no, was that Lyme, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis all at the same time. Good times.
Lovely.
Yes. And so this person was treated for ehrlichiosis and was given a short course of antibiotics. And we're going to see if we can get her to lengthen the course of antibiotics, but we're sending her back to her doc to get more stuff. We're going to see about that. And then there's always natural medicine things that we can do. So for you and your babesiosis, you're doing the Nutramedics protocol. So you're taking cementobanderol, and you're also taking Anula now. And Anula is a preparation of elecampane. And elecampane is a nice herb. It's not, even though the Nutramedics products tend to be rainforest herbs, like your cemento is basically cat's claw, and your berber is also a rainforest herb, and banderol as well. But Anula is elecampane, which grows in the east, I shouldn't say the east. It grows in the west. And so it's a western herb, but it happens to be antiparasitic, which is why we're giving it to you. And you also had a one-week course of azithromycin and atovaquone. So tell us about the atovaquone.
Which is that?
The yellow stuff.
The yellow stuff. Ooh, it's yellow. It stains everything. You got to be careful with it.
Yeah.
You can get it all on your, right. You get it in your hands and it stains your hands.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It tastes yucky.
Tastes yucky or because it's sweet. They it's clearly been flavored.
Yeah, it's not the flavor I would choose.
Okay, but
you
it's
know,
a gross taste.
It's kind of gross. It's got a weird gross taste, and it's got like a strange kind of foamy consistency.
Yeah,
which is a little weird.
Yeah,
and it's yeah. And what is that doing for me?
I don't know why atovaquone comes that way. Azithromycin is just another antibiotic. You ever hear of getting a Z-pack?
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you have bronchitis, you get a Z-pack. That's what
right.
azithromycin is. But azithromycin will go after babesiosis.
Okay.
As atovaquone is an antimalarial.
Okay.
So because babesiosis, yay, is an intracellular parasite.
Mm.
How cool is that?
I love my parasites, and they love me too.
Yeah, well, they're very happy to be inside you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So when you have an intracellular parasite, it can make you anemic, or it can just make your red blood cells not function so well.
Yeah.
What a drag. How is your exercise tolerance now?
My tolerance for exercise? Hot and cold.
Really?
Hot
so
cold.
You have
some days better than others.
Right. Because you were able to knock it out of the park when you climbed Chew Ink Road that day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you did really well with that.
Yep. And so that's okay. And then there are other days that I get on my bike and I just, don't have it.
No.
So, but, you know, I mean, that's kind of a normal thing anyway for most people is that, you know, some days you're good and sometimes you're not.
Yeah.
Because you could be tired for whatever reason.
But you have extenuating circumstances. We're trying to dial in your thyroid and you have babesiosis and you have Lyme disease. It's like, how did this even happen?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, it's a combination of stress and living in Connecticut.
Yeah, it's annoying is what
yeah.
it is.
Well, we had beautiful Frances come and visit us last week. And, you know, I figured Frances would want to go for walks with me. And she definitely did. So we went for a walk in the woods. I insisted she use bug spray. So we, you know, if I go walking, if I spend any kind of time outside, because I don't want to, like, not be outside. I'm not as concerned if I'm on my bike, although being on my bike, I should be somewhat concerned because sometimes you have to get off your bicycle and stand in the grass for whatever reason. For example, if you have to use the woods for certain purposes, or very simply, if you're in a group on a group ride or even by yourself and you get a flat or a mechanical, you're going to be standing by the roadside because you shouldn't be in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be standing in the grass. So having bug spray on hand, whether you wear it from going out, or if you carry a small container of bug spray, because you can get like pocket size bug sprays, natural bug sprays that you can carry in your pocket. I have one that's like a nice little thing that you can throw in your pocket. It's not like a big container of bug spray that you can carry with you and you can reapply. And so if you're like, well, I don't want to put the bug spray on because I'm not planning on being by the roadside, but then you find yourself there, you can spray yourself down while you're waiting for your flat or while you work before you work on your flat, if that's what you're going to do. Mm. In my case, I would be waiting for someone to fix my flat. But anyway, so carrying bug spray. So this is the thing. It's my solution to living in Connecticut is I have to be outside. And you know, a few weeks ago we had our beloved Kurt Beale, who's that's his wheelhouse, studying and learning and promoting being outdoors for healing and health. I'm not going to stop being outside, but the trade-off is bug spray all the time. And I mean, really, if you're going to be outside for any length of time, bug spray. And certainly, you know, even when you go on the rail trail, right now we're at that time of year where if you go less than 7 miles an hour on your bike, you get those little tiny flies that fly around your face. I don't know if they're gnats or black flies or what they, because they don't seem to bite. They just fly around your face.
They're annoying.
They're annoying.
They get in your eyes.
Get in your eyes, and they get on your face.
Sometimes they get up your nose.
And so on Monday, we went for a 92-degree bike ride with Saul. And Saul said that to me. He said, I found that the speed for keeping the bugs away, 7 miles an hour. It's so interesting that people all come to that own conclusion, that same conclusion independently. 7 miles an hour is the cutoff. If you go below 7 miles an hour, the bugs catch you.
Oh, yeah. You're not going fast enough. Yep.
Right. But over 7 miles an hour, they don't bite you.
Right.
That's why we have that joke, bug bitingly slow.
That's right. And that's why if you are, you know, running, you tend to get bit more.
Right, because you're not going 7 miles
yeah,
an hour.
Yeah, and I used to have runs that I would go on that would be, I would count the number of deer flies that I killed.
Yeah.
On the run as to the, you know, the intensity of the deer fly population.
Yeah, apparently deer fly time is now. Because I've had
it
some.
It is.
Yeah, that's right. I had one land on me.
And there are those, you know, like housefly size flies that have teeth the size of a cow.
Yeah, and they
I
take
know
a
they
chunk
do.
Out
they
of
must,
your leg.
They must have teeth the
I
size
know,
of a cow.
I know, you bleed. It's so weird. So bug spray. Mm. And if you don't want to use DEET, you can use Bio-UD. Bio-UD isn't a brand. It's a brand name for an ingredient. So you find a bug spray that has it in it, and it's a tomato extract. It doesn't smell great, but it doesn't smell like DEET. Mm. It just smells a little odd. But it's really effective. And so I have some, and if I'm going to go for a walk in the woods, I do put it on. I'll do a combination. I'll put the citronella and rose geranium and, you know, those combinations of stuff on, as well as the Bio-UD products, because that has that tomato extract in it. It's really, really interesting. And that can help to keep the ticks away. And then the other thing, of course, you do is when you get home, you do thorough tick checks everywhere. And if you're afraid of getting ticks in places you can't see, you need assistance from another human. So, and then also you want to make sure you check your intertriginous zones. You know what an intertriginous zone is?
No.
It's your folds. It's folds. Folds places. So, you know, for women, it's under our breast. It's if you don't have a flat tummy, it's in the folds of your tummy, in the creases of your legs, anywhere you have a fold, definitely check your armpits. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you want to take, this is not an intertriginous zone, you want to check your scalp, because you can definitely get bugs biting you on the scalp. Lots of times ticks will, they'll come from the ground up. Because they sense your carbon dioxide and they smell it and they are attracted to it. So they'll come from the ground up and they'll climb up. And so you definitely want to check your ankles. But you can get a tick bite anywhere. When you hear about people getting tick bites, they're usually the waist and down. But yeah. That doesn't mean you can't get one somewhere else.
So before I took my leave of absence at work, I was talking to the project manager, the guy who pretty much puts all the work crews out and all that.
Yeah.
And he showed me a substance which is very DEET. It's very much DEET.
Yeah.
And he said that he had like a case of it sitting there. I said, where'd you get this? And he got it from that big box store that we call the Evil Store. And he said, this is the absolute best stuff out there. And He said that he tells all the guys that before they get out of the truck in the morning, they put it on their socks and they put it on the lower part of their pants.
Sure.
And that's it. They just put it on their clothing. Mm-hmm. And then they go out because he doesn't want anybody out with Lyme disease.
No.
Because it causes production problems. for them.
Of course.
Obviously, you know, I'm one of them right now. So.
So that's great that they're going to supply, but you didn't get it from installing. You just got it from living
in Connecticut. No, I just got it from, you know, living where I live.
Yeah.
And or maybe I got it from 10 years ago. I don't even know. I don't even know if this is, I never found a bite. I never really discovered anything.
Doesn't matter.
So
70% of people don't see a bite.
Yeah.
But
Didn't see a bite.
Nope.
Didn't see a bite. If I did have anything, it might have been in my scalp, but I'm not really sure.
You don't know, right?
Yeah.
No, and usually you get an erythema migraine. You get disseminated erythema migraines. You get the rashes all over your body.
Yeah, blotches and patches and rings and stuff, but I didn't get any of that.
Right. Yeah, I've had a bunch of people come in that I've treated, like in the last couple of weeks, three or four or five, I don't even know. A lot of people coming in for Lyme. And the other thing that happens to me is I get a form from the state. The state sees it. The lab sees it, and they send the information to the state. And then I get a form from the state that I have to fill out so they can work on the incense. I got a form for you. I had to send to the state.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a special form that the state sends when they see you have Lyme disease. And there's just some stuff, information I have to check up. Like, did this person have a rash? Did they have an erythema migraines rash? Did they have arthritis? Did they have radiculopathy? Did they have meningitis? So they can track it. I think that's not a bad thing. They want to know your ethnicity. They you know, there's a little bit of information that they want. And, you know, they check off, did you do a culture? It takes me, you know, a minute to fill out and sign, and then we fax it over, and it stays in your chart, and that's that. If you want to see it, I could show it to you. But and I got a different one. I had a patient that had babesiosis. Now, I may get one of those for you. This form was specifically for Lyme disease. There was a separate form for babesiosis that I'd never seen before. And I got this other. So it's another form from the state, but it was babesiosis instead. So I may get one of those for you. I don't know if I'm supposed to initiate those, but the state usually catches up with me and they send it to me and I have to fill it out and send it back. So interesting, huh?
So, yeah. So let's just for a second here. Let's just I can't get this to blow up so I can see it. It would be a whole lot easier. There we go. So West Nile virus.
Yeah.
Everybody's all freaked out about West Nile virus.
Who's all freaked out about West Nile virus?
Well, the CDC, the news media, everybody talks about West Nile virus and how terrible it is and da 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 da. And I'm sure it is terrible.
I don't know if I've ever seen it. I don't know if I've ever seen it in my office. I had a patient once that I thought had West Nile. She thought she had West Nile virus, and she asked me to test her for it. So I did. At the same time, I tested her for tick-borne illnesses. Guess what she had?
What?
Lyme disease.
Lyme disease, of course.
Yeah. She didn't have West Nile virus.
So last year in Connecticut, just as an idea here, neuroinvasive disease cases, there were 18.
West Nile virus.
Non-neuroinvasive disease cases, there were 5, and total was 23.
Wow.
There was one death from West Nile virus.
Yeah. That's terrible.
But how many people get Lyme in a year in the state?
Boy.
Why is the CDC so all over checking this out and recognizing this, and yet they could give a
I can tell you I've treated, in the last couple of weeks, I've treated 4 or 5 people with Lyme disease.
Sure you have.
So, you know, and I don't see a huge number of patients, and I'm just one doctor.
I know.
How many doctors out there are seeing these people come in? How many people up at the walk-in? Because one of the things that happens is a lot of times people's PCPs can't see them acutely. So, and they encourage people to use the walk-ins. So how many people do you think walk in to those walk-ins with erythema migraines rash? And we know that UConn, that the urgent care here up in stores, they see it all the time. They're vigilant. They are really vigilant about it. If they suspect you have Lyme disease, they will treat you for it. And they're looking for it in a really impressive way. So, you know, and so people know that. And I know as a practitioner, when I if I get somebody who can't get into their PCP, I also get people who think I'm their PCP, even though I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want me to be their PCP, but I can't be a primary care physician in the state of Connecticut. And your insurance doesn't think I'm your PCP. It thinks I'm a specialist. But people think that I am anyway. So they come to me first. And I say, okay, but sometimes you need prescription, so I need to send you somewhere. So if they don't have a real PCP and they need to get in yesterday, I send them up to UConn because I'm pretty sure that UConn is going to, they're going to treat them. You know, they're going to recognize it and treat them, and they're not going to have to wait 3 weeks to get a test diagnosis, which some places, I've seen that. I've seen people have docs insist on testing the person before they even give them antibiotics, which is not what you do.
Yep.
This is such a dangerous condition. It can go neurological. It can wear on, but it can be really dangerous. I mean, you're fortunate that you don't have a severe neurological case of Lyme disease and babesiosis. I mean, and we're getting a handle on it. But I mean, this can go really wrong.
Right. And, so the minute can understand
you,
that
the minute you and they're like, oh, you're going to become antibiotic resistant, and I'm like, you know what? Better to risk the antibiotic resistance than to risk neuroborreliosis. Really, the antibiotic resistance we can deal with, even as naturopathic physicians, we especially can, because if you become resistant to ceftriaxone, we've got herbs that can kill all sorts of stuff that you're not going to become resistant to. If we have to majorly garlic you or berberine you or oregano oil you or, you know, silver nanoparticle you, we've got all kinds of stuff that can kill. So I'm not worried about that. And we have all kinds of probiotics. We know how to give you probiotics. We have spore probiotics and we have great mixed probiotics. You can be eating kefir if you're dairy intolerant. You can be doing water kefir. There's great ways to you know, deal with the antibiotic resistance. The antibiotic resistance issue is not nearly as serious as protecting people from the neurological consequences and other consequences of Lyme disease, but especially the neurological consequences.
Right. Last year, total number of cases of Lyme disease in Connecticut. 1,853.
That's all.
You know what I think of that? Probably not.
That's right.
It's probably not right.
And you know how I know? I'll tell you how I know, because I screen people for Lyme disease. People walk in and they don't necessarily have symptoms of Lyme disease, or they might say I have ongoing joint pain. So I screen them, and they have it, or they at least have enough. So they'll have some bands. So the CDC has this guideline that you have to have 3 IgG bands and 2 IgM bands. Those are specific kinds of antibodies, positive on the Lyme Western blot, before they'll give you a positive diagnosis. But that's not really what you're supposed to do. That's a guideline. Even the CDC says it's a guideline. You're supposed to diagnose clinically. But I see people all the time that I'll run their Lyme Western blot and they have at least a few bands positive, even if you might not diagnose, and they might not have symptoms, but even if they're, if they've got those bands there, how did they get there? I think people are exposed to it all the time. I think that, what did you say, 1,083?
No, 1,853.
Oh, 1,853. I think that's a gross underestimate.
Yeah. It has it broken down by county here, too.
Yeah,
If you want to see the...
Yeah, hit me.
Okay, you ready? Fairfield County, 289 cases.
Uh-huh.
Hartford, 216.
Huh.
Litchfield, 131.
Huh.
Middlesex, 200.
Uh-huh.
New Haven, 333.
Ooh.
Yeah, pretty big.
That's interesting.
New London, 387.
Right.
Tolland, 138.
Tolland, 138? That's it?
That's it. That's what it says.
That's ridiculous. Tolland must be a little county.
Tolland, 138.
And they're all in Mansfield.
Yeah, it's 152,000 people in Tolland County.
Yeah.
Versus New London County has 274,000. So
right.
That's a big difference.
And New London so far is the winner.
Windham County is, New London County is the number one. Windham County is 151. But what's 151 and 138? That's 210. Yeah, it's still even between New London, Windham and Tolland County, which is kind of the northeastern corner.
So
that
New
we
London
are in.
is the winner.
New
the
London
loser.
Is the flagship winner. Yeah, 274,000 people, 387 cases.
Yeah, well, the you know why? Because New London County has a big population and it has a fair bit of rural population.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got, even though you think of New London proper and Groton are in New London County,
right.
But you've got, what else is in New London County?
Ledger. Lyme, Connecticut.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
You're right.
Here, so
that's where the limes are.
Here's my catch on it. The ones that have the biggest numbers. Well, let's take New London County. Do you think that maybe there's more awareness down there
in New London County?
Yeah, and that's why there's more reports, because more people go, you know what? I should get this checked because it's been around there for so long.
Yeah.
That I think it's,
and the towns,
I think it's an education
all
thing.
All the Lyme towns are in New London. That's true.
Right.
The Lyme towns are in New London County. Old Lyme, East Lyme, Lyme, had Lyme.
Yep.
Yep. Had yep. Lyme. Because if had you Lyme. Had Lyme, that's where you would in be. That,
oh, God. You went there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was in
so,
had Lyme.
So, you know,
on,
I mean, that could be part of it. Could be part of it that it's just a, you know, it's just people are more aware there. But
right.
But you said you see people with it all the time. How many bands did I have when you tested me?
Oh, a lot. You had at least five. You might have had six or seven. And both IgM and IgG.
I lit it up like a
like
Hanukkah
Christmas
bush.
Tree. Right. Okay, Hanukkah bush. Sure, whatever. Yeah, yours was, there was no doubt. And even your most conservative, you know, IDSA touting, you know, anti-chronic Lyme doctor would have looked at your Western blot and given you antibiotics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Mm-hmm. There was no.
Good.
Oh, yeah. Fabulous.
Well, anyway. So there's the question. How long do you stay on antibiotics?
Until you're well.
Right.
You make that decision. That's what a Lyme literate doctor believes is that you stay. And you don't necessarily have to stay on antibiotics. Some people choose to do natural medicine.
Right.
But you treat until you are well.
Right.
And if that's 2 years, it's 2 years.
Wow.
Absolutely. That's what you do.
Lovely.
And you respect the fact that this is a disease. The Lyme spirochete digs into tissues. It's shaped like a corkscrew in the spirochete form. It digs into tissues and it hides there. There's videos of the spirochete running away from antibiotics and digging into tissues.
Lovely.
That's in the spirochete form. Then you have to remember it has an L form, which is not the spirochete form. That's another form that you have to go after that, interestingly, the tetracyclines like doxycycline will kill those. And I don't know if the cephalosporins, like your Cefprazil that you're taking, I don't know if the cephalosporins will kill it. Your penicillins won't get the L form. And then they can insist. So that's something we have to think about, too. At some point, do we want to give you a cyst buster like tinidazole? And that is something that some Lyme literate docs do. They give you a course of cyst buster because Lyme can insist, and the cysts are impervious to antibiotics. You have to use an antifungal on them.
Okay. I'll do anything right now.
And then
I don't want to ever feel like this again.
And then the other thing is that Lyme makes biofilm.
Mm-hmm.
So you know when you have plaque in your mouth?
Yeah.
You know what plaque is?
Well, yes, I do, but I just can't think of the word for it. But
I'll tell you the word. It's biofilm.
It's biofilm.
That's
okay.
What it is.
All right.
Right. So so when you do xylitol, you know, you have xylitol toothpaste, xylitol candy, xylitol breaks up biofilm.
Hmm.
So, but we don't use xylitol for Lyme disease. We use other biofilm busters, but that's part of the problem with Lyme disease is biofilm. So there's things you can use to break up biofilm. Now, mind you, the Nutramedics products are supposed to go after Lyme in all its forms. And so we've got you on a good cocktail. And we've got you on a cocktail that's supposed to go after Lyme and Babesia. So we're hoping that's going to work for you. But so that's really interesting that the Nutramedic stuff goes after all of that stuff. It's really interesting. And one of the things that goes after Lyme disease is stevia. So that we may switch you to stevia at some point if we decide that that's right for you. We do the stevia instead of the cemento. And the stevia that was studied to go after Lyme disease was Nutramedic stevia.
Okay.
So we can get that for you, and if we decide that if you want to take that,
I just want it gone.
Gone, right?
Yeah.
And it may take
time.
I just
don't want to feel like this.
When I had it for the first time, I treated myself. I had 6 weeks of antibiotics, and I treated myself with natural medicine for 6 months. That's what I did. That's what I had to do. And then I felt like I was relatively cleared of it. And then a couple of years ago, last year I decided I had it again. You remember when my knee blew up last year?
Yep.
Even though I was definitely injured, I didn't feel right. And I treated myself for Lyme disease last year. I'm not 100% sure I had it or was newly bitten or if it was a reemergence. And there's controversy about whether it's... about whether it can reemerge, whether it can hide and reemerge. It makes sense that it can hide because of the nature of the spirochete, that it can burrow into tissues and hide there and you know, get out of your and get out of the system. And then there's the whole question about bioengineering, that there's an investigation going on about whether it had been bioengineered. Because it really is insidious and it really is persistent. You know, it's very hard to kill, and not all docs. There are doctors who buy the line that if you are treated for a short course of antibiotics for Lyme disease and you're not well at the end of them, you have something else, which is so ridiculous because I've seen so many patients come in. They have symptoms that really seem to be Lyme disease. They have joint pain that comes and goes and travels. They have brain fog. They have fatigue. You know, they have particular joints that are swollen. They have rashes, and you give them antibiotics and everything gets better. And then they finish the course of antibiotics, which is maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And then all their symptoms come back. And the doc says, you have something else. And they're like, are you kidding me? Because they feel exactly like they felt in the beginning. Why wouldn't you continue to give the antibiotics? But there's a belief that chronic Lyme isn't a thing. But fortunately, we seem to be amongst practitioners that don't believe that. And that are supportive. So, you know, we'll have to continue, you know, we'll continue to work on this, and we'll use a combination of pharmaceuticals and natural medicine to get you out of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you've been hypothyroid for a long time, we don't know how long you were hypothyroid for, because I mean, I think I measured your thyroid a few years ago and you were fine, but you know, you usually, so what I'm not sure of is this a case of you have Lyme thyroiditis, that the Lyme actually went after your thyroid, and this is directly a result of the Lyme, and that once you get clear of your Lyme, your thyroid will go back to normal? I don't know. Or
I asked you that question. Yeah, I was curious.
I don't know the answer to that, because usually I tried to look it up and I tried to research it and I haven't found anything on it. So if you look at what's out there, the idea is that if you're hypothyroid, you're genetically predisposed to it, and your Lyme disease just brought it on because it was a stress, but you were already predisposed to it. Because most people who get Lyme disease don't get a thyroiditis with it. But I don't see why it couldn't happen, because it can attack any tissue at all. But if you have a genetic predisposition to having Hashimoto's or being hypothyroid, you know, you get Lyme disease and your immune system is trying to fight against it, you certainly can convert and get Hashimoto's. So that's a drag. So if you want to call in and talk about this with us, you can call us. If you have an experience about Lyme disease, or if this is of interest to you and you have something to contribute, you can call us. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. Ron is anxiously awaiting your call.
Talk to me about Lyme.
Yeah, so I thought we'd go to a related topic, which is part of why we think you're having such a hard time fighting this Lyme, which is the effects of stress on your body. Yeah, so I thought we'd do a little sidebar about stress today. So stress can stress all by itself, and that's one of the things that's what I say. You might think that Lyme is the thing I treat the most. It isn't. I really think the thing I treat the most is stress.
Ooh.
People who are not stressed don't come in. But if you have somebody who has a chronic ongoing something or other, usually they have some level of stress. And I see people, it just breaks my heart that they're like a little on a tiny island and they're surrounded. So they have a parent that's ailing that they're taking care of. They have children who are living in the house and have psychiatric issues, or they have addiction issues. They have a job that's extremely stressful that they don't like, or that just the nature of the job is really stressful. And they work long hours. They have financial stressors, and they have all of these things going on all at the same time. And they're coming into me. How can I fix this? And I'm like, you know, what can you get rid of? What can you let go of? And of course, people want to look after their ailing parent. They want to be, you know, there for their, you know, addicted children. They want to take care of their grandchildren, and they have to go to their job because they can't financially stop it. But it's like, I always have to talk to them about what part of the train can you stop? You know, which train can you stop? Can you jump off of? and stop dealing with, so you can alleviate their stress. And then, of course, I talk to them about stress-reducing activities, things that you can actually do to alleviate stress. Obviously, you know, in naturopathic medicine, one of the basic principles is treat the cause. You want to treat the cause of whatever is going on. I had somebody a couple weeks ago come in, and they were diagnosed with gastritis, and their doctor told them, take Tums. And I'm like, no, don't take Tums. Tums neutralizes stomach acid. Stomach acid is good for you. If you have gastritis, you need to treat the cause of the gastritis. You need to look at your stress level, because stress can cause gastritis. And then there's probably something you're eating that's inflaming your stomach. That's what you have to work on. And then if you want relief, then let us give you something that doesn't block your stomach acid, so you get to still have your stomach acid to disinfect your food, to assist with the absorptions of your vitamins and minerals, and to initiate your protein digestion. Because hydrochloric acid let's block your hydrochloric acid and let's block your cholesterol, because they're bad. They're bad, bad, bad. You shouldn't have any hydrochloric acid and you shouldn't have any cholesterol. Ah!
Mm-hmm.
Cholesterol is a precursor to so many, to reproductive hormones, to vitamin D. It's part of all of your cell membranes. Anyway, I go on. So the effect of stress on your body. So stress, when you have high cortisol is designed to be a one-shot deal and put you into fight or flight so that you can fight or flee. It's not meant to be a chronic low-grade level of elevated cortisol that you have all the time. That wasn't the idea when the goddess invented your adrenals. Okay, your adrenals were there to support you in acute situations and to support your immune system when you had invading microorganisms, and otherwise to be just, you know, surveilling you, not to be kicking out cortisol and norepinephrine all the time. So, unfortunately, we live in 21st century North America, and 21st century North America is stressful.
Yeah.
And I say 21st century North America. You know why I say that? Because no. I got in the habit of saying 21st century North America because I used to, the first place I practiced was in Canada. So instead of saying 21st century America, I would say it's 21st century North America. But I feel like the United States is more stressed. To live in the United States is more stressful overall than to live in Canada. Because, you know, in Canada, they have health care. In Canada, they have Justin Trudeau.
Yeah.
Canada, they have... you know, just a more overall, just a more compassionate society that you just don't have the, and they're afraid to come down here. They're like, whoa. Well, a lot of people are afraid to come to the United States right now because of what's going on. But anyway, so ongoing stress, you're supposed to be in fight or flight. So what can it do to you? It can, when you have increased cortisol and norepinephrine, you can get every system in your body can be affected. So it can give you headaches, and it's going to give you headaches because you're going to be tense, simply because you're going to be tense. And when you're tense, you're going to tense up your muscles, and the muscles around your head are going to be tense. So you can get more tension headaches. You probably can get more migraines too, because when you have stress hormones around, affect the blood flow going in and out of your brain and around your brain. So you can get more migraines as well. Chronic stress can certainly affect your mood. One of the things that's going on is you're kicking out neurotransmitters to help you deal with the stress. And one of them is norepinephrine. Norepinephrine is thought to be one of the neurotransmitters that helps you to have a happier mood. And if you're using it all the time for your stress, you're going to eventually deplete it. And so then you're going to be depressed. Obviously, it's going to affect your sleep, because if your cortisol is high all the time, you're on guard. You're in fight or flight and your brain is not quiet. You're not going to be able to go to sleep. You can get heartburn. You can get any digestive issue, but you can certainly get heartburn because... when you're stressed, you actually make more stomach acid. It stimulates digestion, and it does stimulate the production of stomach acid. And so that can also lead to gastritis. And, so when people come in and they have gastroesophageal reflux or they have gastritis, I talk to them about their stress level. And so, reducing your stress can calm that down. it can weaken your immune system. Very obviously, because the hormones that you kick out when you have when you're trying to use your immune system, they can be depleted. And if they're not as available, if they're there trying to get it so that you finish that report or you go pick up your kids or you do all the 20 million things that you're doing in your life, they're not going to be as available to actually run your immune system. That's why we tell you when you're sick, the first thing you do is you go to bed, you go to rest, so that you're not, so that you're using your adrenal hormones to run your immune system, not to run your picking up your kids, going to the supermarket and going to your work. If you're doing all those things, you're going to be sick longer. That's just how it works. And you're more likely to pick up illnesses. You're going to breathe faster. So when you're, obviously you're going to breathe faster just because, you know, your body thinks you're about to run away from a bear. So you're going to hyperventilate. When you hyperventilate, you don't breathe it as deeply. And by the way, long, slow, deep breaths oxygenate you better, fill your lungs better, and lowers cortisol. So slowing your breathing down, if you're, you know, stuck in traffic, if you can do some deep breathing, you'll bring your cortisol down. It's a great way to do it. It does increase your risk of having a heart attack when you have high stress, because cortisol is irritating to your blood vessels. High stress will make you more likely to get coronary artery disease and cardiovascular disease, simply because cortisol's job is to run around and find tissue in your body and turn it into sugar, so it can put it into your blood so you can run away from the bear. It doesn't care where it gets the sugar, and if it's in your blood, the cortisol is in your blood, it's going to go after your blood vessels. And that's why people get heart attacks when they're stressed, because the cortisol is in their blood, it's eating their blood vessels and dumping the protein into your blood, and you're doing gluconeogenesis, and now you have sugar, and now you can run away from the bear, except that you're probably not running away from the bear and you're getting the next thing, which is high blood sugar. So you're more likely to become diabetic or pre-diabetic when you're under a lot of stress, because what did I just say? Cortisol looks for anything it can, and it breaks it down, turns it into sugar, puts it in your blood so you can run away from the bear. Except you're not running away from a bear.
No.
So if you're not actually exercising and you have that high blood sugar, at the very least, you're going to gain weight, and you're going to gain it right in your tummy. So obviously, you can have a fast heart rate and high blood pressure from from being under stress, from having too much cortisol, because it's going to increase your blood pressure so that you have more blood flowing in your skeletal muscle so you can run away from the bear. And of course, it's going to increase your heart rate to get it there faster. And so you can react better. We already said you're going to get a tummy. Your whole digestive system can be affected by stress, because the same neurotransmitters that affect your brain and affect your thought processes and your emotions, you have receptors for all of those in your digestive system. So if your digestive system is hit by stress hormones, you're going to be more in fight or flight than in rest and digest. So any food that goes down is not going to be properly digested. It can cause fertility problems. This makes complete sense. Why? Because if you're in fight or flight and you need to run away from bears and marauding invaders, nature is not going to want you to get pregnant or be able to make a woman pregnant. So you can get erectile dysfunction, and you can get less sperm production, and you can also just not be able to conceive if you're a woman. And nature's so brilliant about this. When you ovulate, your egg breaks into an your follicle breaks into an egg and a corpus luteum. The corpus luteum sits back in your ovary and makes progesterone for you. Progesterone is this wonderful hormone that chills you out and makes you have a nice healthy lining to support your pregnancy. Progesterone has an easy two-step procedure to be converted into, guess what, cortisol. So if your body senses that you're under stress, it's going to take that progesterone and it's going to turn it into cortisol, and you're not going to be able to conceive. And that's a smart thing, because we don't want you pregnant when what you really need to do, nature wants you to survive, and you're going to either survive by running away from the bear or making more of you. And we're not going to have you make more of you if you're in danger. So stress, you know, the stress hormones mean you're in danger. You're also not going to have a sex drive, because the cortisol is going to override the hormones that give you a sex drive. Like it's going to override your dopamine. It's going to override your testosterone, your estrogen, progesterone, all the things that help you have a sex drive. you're going to, and along with that, you might have missed periods again, because you might not even ovulate. So you never build up a lining, so you don't get your period. You might have tense muscles from stress. That's not surprising at all. Simply because it makes you tense up. And when you're not relaxing, you know, the muscles will stay contracted. So how do you undo this? Well, like I said, the first thing that you have to do is look at what's stressing you out and see what you can let go of in your life. If you have a difficult relationship, you need to either work on the relationship or get out of it. If you are caring for, if you're being a caregiver for a loved one, or, you know, for a loved one or a friend or something like that, you may not want to stop being their caregiver, but you need respite. You need ways to rest from that. You need people to tag team you, and you need to not be doing it all the time, because that can be very, very stressful and very painful, especially if it's an ongoing long-term thing. So if you have a job situation that's not right for you, I always talk about three campaigns with the job situation thing, because this happens all. I see this all the time. People are unhappy in their jobs and they feel trapped, that they can't get out. You know, they might have a job that has great benefits, but they're really unhappy at the job and they feel like they have to stay. So I'll talk to them about, is there any way you can make the job that you have right now happier? Can you listen to music? Can you put up plants? Can you put up pictures of things that make you happy? Nature things or your family? Can you take breaks during the job to do things that make you, that reduce your stress? Can you make good relationships at your job to just make it a happier place? And if you really can't do that, what's your campaign to get out of it? Do you want to start applying for other jobs now? Do you want to wait it out? And some people, they just have to wait it out. If people are of a certain age, and even if they're not, I ask them, when can you retire? If people are in their 40s or higher, and they have a stressful job, I ask them when they can retire. And, you know, there are high-risk jobs that people can retire in their 40s. So if you're a police officer or in the military, or, you know, when you're some kind of security, if you're a corrections officer, you can often retire in your 40s because it's high risk. And I beg people to do that. Yeah. And so if they're older than that, I'm like, okay, when can you retire? And a lot of people say to me, well, I can retire, but I'm not going to get as good a pension, and I'm still going to have to work. I'm like, okay, so, you know, retire and then go find something that's less stressful to do. You know, go be an arborist or work in a flower shop. Do they have flower shops anymore? You know, work retail.
There's one in Willimantic.
Oh, okay. Where is it?
Dawson's Florist. Oh. It's over on the other side of the footbridge.
Okay. All right.
It's still there.
Okay. That's great.
I was reminded of it weeks ago.
On a bike
ride.
I just said
something to somebody. I said, there's no flower shops left. They said, oh, yes, there is.
Dawson's is still there.
Yep.
Yeah, so I don't know if they're hiring. But anyway,
no.
Or go work at a nursery. They have those.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's different things. You know, just do something. If you still need money, go see if there's something you can do that's less stressful than what you were doing.
Mm.
So definitely got to work on the job situation. If you have relationship situations, you have to work on those, whether it's with a spouse, a partner, a child, depending on what it is. And if it's a child who's like you're their parent and you have to take care of them and you can't mm-hmm. get rid of them, then you do need respite. You need help with that. You know, sometimes you have to not be taking care of that child. One of the things that's really hard in 21st century North America is, it's more difficult in the United States than it is in Canada, because Canada has good health care, because you can put your child in health care for very inexpensively in Canada. But in the United States, that's not necessarily the case. And one of the issues that we have is we have the nuclear family. So you have two parents and children, and you don't have the support of the tribe, the community, you know, the siblings and the grandparents. And some people just don't have that option available. There's some families do, and it's amazing that, you know, the grandparents are retired and they love taking care of their grandchildren. And so the kids go to grandma and grandpa after school, and that's where they stay until mom and dad come home. So they have wonderful relationships with their grandparents with that. So shout out to grandparents who are doing that, and the grandparents want to do it. They love it.
My mom did that.
Yeah.
Two days a week, she used to come up to the house.
Which is so lovely when that happens. Really, I know that if my mother could do it, she would. You know, she would love to see her grandchildren more often, but we have a geography problem. Anyway, so looking around at your life and reducing the stressors that, so it's one part of it. It's one thing to do stress reducing activities like taking yoga or meditation or going to church or knitting or quilting or, you know, taking naps or being in nature. Those are all great things to do. And those are your restorative activities and they're extremely important. But if there are stressful situations in your life, that's really treating the cause. Mitigating those stressful situations is really important, and that's what you have to do. And you have to be really honest about, okay, what are the stressors in my life and how can I fix them? One of the stressors I hear is that my house is cluttered. I mean, I know we have that problem, and we have the problem of being too busy to do anything about it. So if that's one of your issues and you're excessively busy and you don't feel like you can declutter your house, if you have money, one way to do it would be to pay somebody to help you declutter it or to declutter it for you. If you don't have that kind of money, then one thing to think about is when you have some time, just one drawer at a time, you know, not a whole dresser, but one drawer, one side of your closet or one quarter of your closet. You know, or one category. I'm just going to take care of. I have too many athletic clothes. I'm gonna cull my athletic clothes, and just do that. And when you do it, celebrate. That's great. And don't think about it again until you have some clear time to do that. And the other thing is, if you have clutter and you're way too busy to do anything about it, don't be hard on yourself. That's just how it is. That's going to be that way until you're in a place in your life where you have time to do something about it, or you have money to have somebody help you do something about it, and do what you can when you can. That can be a hard thing to do if you really have a clutter problem. But, you know, I mean, that's what we have to do because we're just, you know, we're two people who are self-employed and, you know, we'd rather be outside this time of year than indoors. So that's what happens. I went into a house not too long ago with some nice friends, and their house is immaculate. And I'm thinking, and it's gorgeous.
I go into a lot of those houses.
I'm like, how do they do it?
I don't know.
I think that must be what it is. Yeah, because you have to keep on top of it. I know when I had a 9-to-5-er, I had a very neat and clean house because I was on top of it. If something, there was too much stuff, I got rid of it. And I had time to surveil it all the time. I just don't have the time or energy to do that when I'm, you know, regularly getting home at 9, 10 o'clock at night. It's just not going to happen. So I don't keep on top of it. So anyway, so there's some advice there to deal with your stress. And I didn't even talk about supplements, but I have to say that taking the supplements, like, you know, you can take phosphorylated serine, Serifos, which will reduce your cortisol. You can take ashwagandha, Eleuthero. You can take ginseng and rhodiola. Those are all herbs that are really great for reducing stress. Holy basil is another one. Those are all really helpful. Magnesium, if you have sore muscles especially, magnesium can be helpful. So there's definitely supplements that you can take that are going to help. But the main thing is if you're under a lot of stress, you have to adjust your life. And if you have guidance from a good practitioner, they'll be able to give you specific tips on how to deal with that. So, all right. So that's what I got this week. So you've been listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, and you have been listening to Radio Naturopath. Let me get down here. That guy over there is my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Doors.